Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Senior Editor Kelly Davio. The Biosimilars Council, a part of the Association for Accessible Medicines, recently issued a white paper in which it condemns abuses of the patent system that delay biosimilar competition. The paper estimates that the financial impact of these delays has cost the U.S. healthcare system $7.5 billion in lost savings since 2015 and $7.6 billion since 2012. This week on the podcast, we're speaking with Christine Simon, Executive Director of the Biosimilars Council, about the paper, about patent thickets, and about what policy issues the Council wants to see addressed to move the needle on biosimilars. Christine, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Not So Different.
Thank you, Kelly. This will be fun.
So the Biosimilars Council recently published a white paper that says that the low number of available biosimilars in the U.S. is a direct result of the patent schemes used by some brand name pharmaceutical companies to maintain their lucrative product pricing monopolies. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what forms those schemes you're talking about are taking?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's a little complicated, but you know, while innovation is a great thing and certainly warrants patent protection, unfortunately, some branded biologic manufacturers accumulate patents not because they're innovative, but rather to increase litigation and development costs for potential biosimilar competitors. And these accumulated patents, which we can call patent thickets, chill competition because they discourage competitors from entering the market because they must face an exorbitant cost of litigating these meritless patents. And I think you need look no further than Humira, AbbVie's product, as a glaring example of this problem. It was first approved in 2002, and it treats a variety of diseases like arthritis and psoriasis and Crohn's disease, and it's a great product, a great medicine for patients, but it is prohibitively expensive, more than $60,000 a year. And while Humira's 12-year statutory market exclusivity expired in 2014, and its principal patent expired in 2016, AbbVie filed more than 75 late-stage patents in the 3 years prior to the 2016 expiration, specifically to delay biosimilar competition. And as a result, the last Humira patent won't expire until 2034. And although four Humira biosimilar competitors have been approved to date by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, none are available to patients due to these thickets. And I wish I could say Humira was an isolated example, but it's not. Many other brand biologic companies use this tactic of patent thicketing to prevent competition from biosimilars. And we are working with policymakers to try and address the situation and stop this kind of gamesmanship.
You mentioned working with policymakers. What are some of the things that we can do about patent abuses? And are there any policy proposals that are on the table right now that could maybe help mitigate some of these practices?
There are. And one of the better ones is the Biologic Patent Transparency Act. It's a bill introduced by Senator Susan Collins that would help mitigate patent thicketing by requiring the biologic manufacturer to submit and publicly list all patents in the FDA's new Purple Book, which is, I'm sure your listeners know, a publicly available listing of biologic patents. And so if the manufacturer didn't list its patents, it would not be able to assert them against the biosimilar manufacturer during litigation. There is a different version of this bill that was recently passed by the HELP Committee as part of a package, and it would still, that too would be effective in mitigating some of these practices. We've also supported moving up the patent dance that is outlined in the legislation defining the biosimilars pathway in the BPCIA, because doing so would speed the process in terms of wading through the thicket and getting out there on the market.
You mentioned moving up the patent dance from where it is now in the BPCIA. How early in the process would the council like to see the patent dance take place?
Well, there are different approaches to this. There are different stages during the patent dance, and so we're focusing on the time period around sort of the type three meetings that happen, and that might be an opportunity. So I think there are some different approaches on the table, but the important point would be to have an earlier opportunity.
So one really interesting feature of the white paper is that the council says that settlements like the ones that are going to allow biosimilar adalimumab to reach the U.S. market not sooner than by 2023, the paper says that these are not inherently a bad thing. Can you talk a bit about why the council sees these settlements as being pro-competitive in nature?
Yes, absolutely. We do see these settlements as being pro-patient and pro-competition, mainly because settling is an alternative to bringing a challenge of a potentially non-innovative patent all the way to the conclusion of litigation. That's a very expensive endeavor. There's no guarantee of success for the biosimilar competitor. Costs to litigate a patent are estimated to be roughly $3 million, and that's per patent. We just talked about AbbVie bringing 75 late-stage patents, right? So, we don't view settlements as being inherently bad, particularly when they bring a product to market prior to the patent expiry date. And the rules around this were really established back in 2013 when the U.S. Supreme Court handed down their decision in Federal Trade Commission versus activist case, in which they determined that agreements that had large and unjustified reverse payments may be potentially anti-competitive when combined with a market entry date that goes beyond patent expiry. And that's what's meant by the term we often hear, which is pay for delay. And we, of course, do not support pay for delay, but we do support the opportunity to settle a case to bring a product to market sooner than patent expiry. And since that Supreme Court decision and the FTC's increased engagement, the total number of patent settlement agreements has increased. But the FTC has found the number of potentially anti-competitive agreements, to have dramatically declined. In fact, only one since 2013. So, in our view, settlements pave the way to earlier entry. They avoid expensive and burdensome litigation costs, and the ability for two parties to enter a settlement agreement is a pro-competitive opportunity.
So you mentioned that FTC report that shows that anti-competitive settlements are in fact on the decline rather than on the uptick, even though there is some renewed interest among lawmakers with these kinds of settlements. Your paper also mentions that giving bodies like the FTC more authority to regulate agreements that end patent litigation could have some unintended consequences by rewarding companies who create patent thickets. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Yes, some of the proposals that have been on the table to address so-called pay for delay would change the legal standard for these types of agreements and presume them all unlawful or anti-competitive unless proved otherwise. And in turn, that could make biosimilar manufacturers much more likely to wait until all the patents are expired rather than incur the costs and risks associated with challenging patents. Or having to prove them not to be unlawful or anti-competitive. And in that way, patient access to more affordable medicines would continue to be delayed.
So patents are, of course, one big issue in the U.S. biosimilars market, but of course we have no shortage of other challenges. Are there some other issues that you can talk about that you think need to be addressed in order to move the needle on U.S. biosimilars?
There are a few, Kelly. I think, we think of them really in two buckets, the challenges to getting into the market for biosimilars and staying in the market. There are policy opportunities in both categories. Getting in the market, actually launching a product in the U.S. And I think as of right now, there are 21 approved, but only 7 launched, is really directly related to the patent abuses and patent thickets that we have been discussing. Staying in is really about creating a sustainable market for biosimilars once they actually can get to market. And there are some challenges around that as well. For example, exclusionary contracting practices and the rebate trap, where a biologic company uses anti-competitive market access tactics like rebating schemes that keep biosimilars off formularies or put them on higher tiers, and even bundling these rebates across the entire portfolio of medicines that a manufacturer might offer to a payer, and threatening to remove rebates for the entire bundle, not just the biologic, unless a biosimilar is excluded from the market. And we found that, you know, this is a significant barrier. The biosimilar manufacturer, in order to gain market share, would really have to enter the market at such a significant discount that it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be at all profitable for the biosimilar manufacturer, and obviously that stifles development. We've seen this, you know, addressed in the Pfizer and versus J&J lawsuit. So it's happening across the sector, not just between biologic and biosimilars, but between biologics and other biologics. You know, basically, if a brand name manufacturer can eliminate the financial viability of manufacturing a competitor, then there's just no potential for future investment. And you know, the monopolies will continue to persist. There are opportunities to correct this. You could make some changes to Medicare Part D formulary design that would require coverage of biosimilars and provide preferential tier placement and lower cost sharing for patients, as long as the biosimilar is less expensive than the reference product. So that would go a long way. And then, of course, the rebate rule proposal that's being under consideration at this time, that would also help address this problem, particularly combined with the changes to the Part D formulary design. Another key concern is stakeholder misinformation. There still is sort of a pernicious effort by some brand biologics manufacturers to suggest that biosimilars are inferior to reference products. You know, we saw in the Pfizer citizen petition to the agency that that some brand manufacturers exploit a lack of stakeholder understanding to sow seeds of doubt that biosimilars are as safe and effective as their own products, you know, once they've been approved by the FDA. And in addition to these efforts, there are some policies like the FDA's current policy on naming, which creates a real difference in the name of reference products and their biosimilars, which kind of adds to this issue. And the entire concept really of interchangeability, which, you know, is a designation that we only have here in the United States, that otherwise globally biologics, all biologics are presumed are, you know, interchangeable with each other, therefore making biosimilars interchangeable as well. And these kinds of, creating these kinds of distinctions in the name and with the interchangeability designation emphasize that biosimilars are, you know, potentially questionable to the exact people who need them most, the patients. And they also undermine the confidence of providers. So we think that these are issues that, you know, the FDA has been great about educating around the safety and efficacy of biosimilars, but much more work needs to be done. And then I guess I would end with just talking about a need for better reimbursement incentives for the medical benefit in Medicare Part B for biosimilars to increase utilization. And we've proposed a number of policy options for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and Congress to consider including primarily, you know, eliminating cost sharing for patients when they are prescribed biosimilar in Part D. So they would have a $0 copay in Part B. And then another option would be to institute a shared savings program for providers in Part B. If a provider prescribes a biosimilar over the reference product, they could, you know, share in the savings and obtain a part of the difference in the cost. And that would incentivize the providers as well as realize savings for Medicare Part B as a program. So we think that there are real opportunities here to continue to foster the growth and development of the biosimilars market. We're coming up on the 1-year anniversary of FDA's biosimilars action plan that the former commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, had introduced. And, you know, when we look at that and we look at where we are now, there have been some accomplishments, but there's still a long way to go.
Well, are there any closing thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with today?
I would just echo a recent health affairs blog piece written by Alex Brill of Matrix Global Advisors. He wrote that piece as a sort of rebuttal to a prior article by Dr. Peter Bach from Sloan Kettering, who had suggested that, you know, from a policy perspective and from an economic perspective, biosimilars might not make sense. And he even went so far as to basically suggest abandoning the biosimilars, you know, development and marketplace because, in his view, it's not working, and it's not working quickly, and biologics are, you know, have a monopoly. But I would just suggest that there are many policy opportunities that can foster the growth and development of biosimilars, and that we as patients and providers and payers and even taxpayers, that we all have a role in ensuring that we pursue the great opportunity that biosimilars present to us in terms of access to care and savings for the healthcare system.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Christine. We appreciate hearing your perspective on this.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Not So Different. For more about the Biosimilars Council's white paper, visit our show notes. As always, if you like the show, we welcome you to rate us at iTunes. Until next time, find us at centerforbiosimilars.com.